Vice President Kamala Harris has been tasked with addressing the root causes of migration from Central America.
Let's talk about what's going on in the places that are causing the issue at the border. I think it's short-sighted for any of us who are in the business of problem-solving to suggest we're only going to respond to the reaction as opposed to addressing the cause. And so that is the approach we are taking. When the president asked me to deal with this issue, it was about addressing the root causes of migration. And the root causes are based on the problems and the challenges that people are facing in countries like Guatemala.
Today, we're joined by NMSU Government Department Head Dr. Neil Harvey, economist Dr. Chris Erickson, and Associate Professor of Economics Jose Buccelli. And your questions are welcome. 575-646-2212. We'll get started right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media. It's 106. Good afternoon. Welcome to Voice of the Public from KRWG Public Media. This is KC Counts, and I'm so glad to have you join us today, however you're listening, on your radio at 90.7 in Las Cruces and far west El Paso as well, or across southern New Mexico, wherever you are joining us on your radio or listening online at krwg.org from anywhere in the world, or maybe you're following along on Facebook. Thank you for joining us for Voice of the Public. Just a few minutes ago, you heard Vice President Kamala Harris talk about addressing the root causes of migration. So we have asked some special guests to join us today to discuss that very topic. They include NMSU Government Department Head Dr. Neil Harvey. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I guess I should disclose that I'm currently in Dr. Harvey's Latin American politics class. And so being in that class was something that really has opened my mind to what may be many of the root causes of migration. So glad to have you here today to share some of your knowledge.
Thank you.
We're also joined by economist Dr. Chris Erickson. Welcome to the program, Dr. Erickson.
Thanks for having me on, Casey. I appreciate the invite.
Well, and I thought that that the economic angle would be an important part of this discussion today. So thank you for joining us. And then you suggested that we also invite Associate Professor of Economics, Dr. Jose Buccelli. Welcome to the program, Dr. Buccelli. Glad to have you along.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start with you, Dr. Harvey, because as we hear the Vice President talk about addressing the root causes of migration, this is obviously a very big, complex issue. And so I'd really like to start by having you summarize for us the best way that you can, you know, what some of the root causes exist from the beginning, talking about from colonial times.
Okay, yeah, well, that is a big topic, a big swathe of history, of course. So, but I think some of the common themes and legacies from colonial times in Central America are the inequality of Central American societies, the vast differences in wealth and resources in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, the three countries which tend to send most migrants in the most recent years. And those inequalities have been, I think, upheld politically by the control over national government, by the very elite groups in those countries, and often backed by United States policy to the region, which has tended to ally with the local elites or oligarchies to support U.S. interests, economic interests, and geopolitical interests, particularly during the Cold War. So ever since colonial times, I think right through the period of independence in the 19th century, up through the 20th century, I think the United States has had a big hand in the situation in Central America that we're still seeing today, in making sure that those groups remain in power. But they're doing so in the face of opposition movements and opposition political parties, which have sought to introduce reforms of different types and different scale. And one of the cases, which hopefully we'll have time to come back to later, is the case of Honduras, which has presidential and legislative elections coming up at the end of November of this year. And I think that case, so the country of Honduras and its political situation, brings to a head some of these contradictions that the United States has often supported the local oligarchies or elites in countries like Honduras and Central America. But currently, as we heard from Vice President Harris, to address the root causes also means to address impunity and corruption in government. And that is something which we've seen when political elites are not held accountable or suppress opposition violently or through electoral fraud. So the current situation in Honduras is really critical, I think, for the United States to pay attention to the election that's coming up and avoid a repetition of fraudulent elections that took place in 2013 and 2017.
Dr. Buccelli, how important do you think it is to consider the legacies of colonialism when dealing with the problems that we are seeing today?
So Dr. Harvey provided a very good background of the general context of the region. But I want to emphasize that there's instability. When we talk about instability in the Northern Triangle, the countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, we're talking about corruption and impunity, but we're also talking about military coups. We're talking about civil wars. We're talking about long-term inequality and poverty that certainly has created the context that we're seeing in today in the form of migration flows.
Dr. Erickson, can you speak to U.S. economic policy towards Central America and how...
Yeah, sure. So the United States has engaged it in Latin America to a large extent over many years, and I'd have a slightly different take than Dr. Harvey on the role of the United States. It's not so much the United States is supporting elites as elites are using the United States for their own ends. Where I do agree with Dr. Harvey is, and with Jose also, is the tremendous importance of the legacy of colonialism. We have studies in economics that go look around the world, not just in Latin America, but around the world, that show that the legacy of colonialism, and in more recent times in neocolonialism, is extremely important in determining the economic outcomes in countries. And if you look at Latin America, this is a region where the indigenous people were essentially enslaved, where elites have ruled since colonial times, and where to a large extent even attempts by the Spanish Empire to impose very, very basic human rights were not followed by the local elites. Just to give you an example that maybe the listeners will be familiar with is the exploits of Don Iñate here in New Mexico. He was not following the rules being consistent with the rules of even the very limited rules of Spain in his actions in New Mexico, particularly against the indigenous peoples, the Pueblo people. How do you break that legacy of colonialism is a very difficult problem, very hard to overcome, and I'll be interested to hear what my colleagues say about that as we go forward.
Oh, indeed. And let me give you the telephone number if you would like to jump in. Questions, comments, join us on Voice of the Public at 575-646-2212. If you are following along on Facebook, you can also leave a comment or question anytime. We're glad to hear from you that way as well. Dr. Harvey, you mentioned Honduras specifically, and I'd like to for you to address that Northern Triangle and what it is about those three countries that we're seeing so much out-migration.
Okay, I think several factors are combining at the same time to produce large-scale out-migration from the northern part of Central America since around 2010. On the one hand, I think is the ongoing poverty and inequality that both Jose and Chris have referred to in the region. I think there's been a worsening of that situation since 2010. Partly that is related to a second factor, which is the impact of climate change in Central America. There's a large swathe of Central America now referred to as the Dry Corridor, which stretches all the way from southern Mexico down to parts of Nicaragua and Costa Rica, which has really had a huge negative impact on the agricultural sector, particularly for small farmers in the region, simply unable to make a living off the land. And that has been combined with really strong and unseasonal impacts of tropical storms coming in on the Atlantic side of Central America. We've had an alternation of years of drought with no rain at all, and then suddenly very late rains and very torrential rains occurring in November. This time last year, there were two that hit Honduras particularly hard. And that has created a lot of devastation of agricultural land. It's displaced people from their homes. And the third kind of connecting piece to this is that when people are displaced from their land, they're unable to produce enough food. They often move to the cities, and there they become easy prey for the criminal organizations, the cartels, which have established a firm presence in Central American cities, often with complicity of government officials and law enforcement. And it's a very impossible situation to make a living either in the rural areas or be free of extortion in the urban areas that has led many people to migrate and to find or to seek safety elsewhere.
Dr. Buccelli, if you were to address U.S. policy toward this part of the world, where would you begin?
That is a great question, because when we talk about the root causes of migration, we also have to consider the role that the U.S. policies have played in the migration flows. Now, I would like to separate between the traditional U.S. policies and then what happened with the Trump administration. We know that in the U.S., we've had large diaspora populations from El Salvador and other Central American countries that have been welcomed, especially since the early 2000s, by the U.S. through temporary protection status and other means. We also had, under the Obama administration, the creation of the Central American Minors Program, which opened the door for Central American minors to apply for asylum in the U.S. if they had parents already living here. We also had the 2008 Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act that seek to protect minors traveling from contiguous and non-contiguous countries. So we had a lot of those protections in place. Next, with the Trump administration, we have a transition from the traditional protection of asylees and refugees. The administration made significant efforts to limit the asylum system. In 2017, for example, the administration terminated the Central American Minors Program, which allowed for the legal reunification of families. Then in 2018, we had the zero tolerance policies that separated families and minors from their parents. In 2018, we have metering. In 2019, we have cancellation of aid programs for Central America. So there's a lot of policy changes that happened during these times. Now, with the Biden administration, President Biden, a lot of these policies have remained in place. A lot of the policies have changed. The Central American Minors Program has been reinstated. The deportation of certain migrants has been reprioritized. But some of the things, for example, the expulsions under Title 42 continue to this day. Over a million migrants have been expelled under Title 42. Now, what are some of the opportunities, or what are some of the things that the U.S. policies should do now? First is restore the timeliness of asylum applications. Many of these applications take years, months or years even to be resolved. So restoring timeliness would certainly be an opportunity. Removing duplicate processes, fostering interagency collaboration at the border, creating categories of temporary workers in the U.S., restoring collaboration channels with Central American countries, and honestly strengthening the enforcement against human trafficking, but honest human trafficking, not just as an excuse to stop migration.
Dr. Erickson, on the idea of temporary workers in the United States, I'd like for you to address the importance of migrant workers to the U.S. economy and what we're seeing right now in terms of, you know, we're being told there's a severe labor shortage in this country. Do you see an opportunity to address that labor shortage with better immigration policy?
Well, it's, certainly we could have better immigration policy to address labor shortages, but in general, immigration has been the lifeblood of our country. It has historically been very important. If you look in more recent years, when the it's been dominated by immigration from Latin America and Mexico, it has been shown over and over again that immigrants contribute to our economy. You know, one of the things you hear people talk about, well, immigrants come to the United States and they use resources and don't pay taxes. And of course, it's the opposite. Very often they do use resources, they don't use resources to the extent that would a domestic worker, and they pay more in taxes in some cases. Now, when we talk about this, when we look at the border regions of the United States, which are often where immigrants begin their journey within the United States, although it's not true that they necessarily stay here on the border, but there has been a disparate impact on New Mexico, California, and Texas in terms of providing resources to immigrants. And what we need at the national level is a recognition of this and a transfer of covering this by the national government. And the reverse is also true, which is that immigrants tend to use less in federal resources. They tend to collect less in Social Security per dollar contributed. They tend to not use federal programs to the same extent as native or workers, and so the disparity of using local resources, which stresses out communities on the border, is an issue that should be addressed at the national level. It doesn't have much traction, but it's actually a very important issue if we want to mitigate the impact of the immigrants on local regions within the United States.
Dr. Harvey, you mentioned watching Honduras very closely, and I'd like for you to give us some more background in terms of the upcoming election and what we should be looking for and what we should be aware of going into it.
Sure. I bring it up because if one of the root causes that the United States government itself has identified is corruption and impunity, then I think it really underlies everything else. It's really difficult to implement alternative models of for economic development or to invest in new job creation in Central America, which is definitely needed, if the political environment is not based on respect for the rule of law and holding free and fair elections. So in Honduras, I think, as I mentioned, these contradictions are coming together right now, and it's a dilemma. I hope it will be resolved in the favor of support for free and fair elections, but we shall see. In Honduras, like many parts of Latin America, in the period from around 2000 onwards, there were political movements for reform calling for a more fair distribution of the national wealth. And for Central American countries, that had been attempted in a very violent way, I think, in the 1980s through the civil wars that Jose had just referred to. Once those wars came to an end in the 1990s, the issues which had given rise to them hadn't really been resolved. Maybe the military confrontations between revolutionary movements and military governments had been somewhat resolved through peace accords, but the underlying issues are still present. So a president by the name of Manuel Zelaya of the Liberal Party, which is kind of centrist, not particularly a right-wing party, although it has those elements, but more of a centrist party, came to power in 2005 and argued for the implementation of social programs to address the needs of the poor and the majority of Hondurans. And he had a lot of support for doing that, as the majority saw that this was a necessary thing. But he got a lot of pushback from the business elites And eventually he was removed in a military coup in 2009 on the grounds that he was trying to amend the constitution in order to run for office again, although he couldn't run for office in 2009. His term was up. Anyway, he was removed. He was flown out in his pajamas in the middle of night by the military to Costa Rica and wasn't allowed to return for some time. And that led in the opposite party, which is more definitely on the right of the political spectrum, called the National Party, which has governed since. In 2013, Juan Orlando Hernandez was elected president in what many saw as an election marred by widespread fraud and vote rigging. But his election was recognized, it went forward. But it became very repressive of dissent and opposition. And I think this also feeds into why people in Honduras may feel they can't change the situation at home. So when we hear arguments saying, well, why don't people just stay at home and fix their situation there rather than migrate into the U.S.? Well, here's the reason. The Hernandez government came to power with the blessing of the United States also, under both the Obama administration and then the Trump administration. Because in 2017, Hernandez was allowed to run for re-election. The Constitution was amended. It's great irony that the coup in 2019 used as justification that Zelaya was trying to amend the Constitution for consecutive re-election. But in 2015, the Supreme Court, which is stacked with supporters of Hernandez and the National Party, allowed for re-election of Hernandez. And he won narrowly, officially, in 2017. By this time, President Trump was president in the United States, of course. And that was even worse in terms of the violation of electoral laws and attacks on dissidents. Over 15 protesters were killed in the aftermath of that. There was a curfew established by the Hernandez government to quell any kind of dissent. And the Organization of American States, its observers present on the ground, called for new elections to be held. They weren't held. Instead, the dissidents were rounded up and put in prison. And again, the United States government said, okay, we'll accept the results in the end. They disagreed with the way it came about, but the final decision was to accept this and not to support the call for new elections in 2017. Going into the new election now in 2021, 4 years on, Hernandez can't run again, but his close ally, Asfura of the National Party, is running, and he was ahead in the polls until fairly recently. He's been overtaken by Xiomara Castro, who is the wife of Manuel Zelaya, who was deposed back in 2009. And she has now been able to form an alliance, a much broader alliance, with other groups in Honduras concerned about corruption and impunity, and is now leading in the polls as we're about a month away from the elections on November the 28th. In Honduras, the system is it's only a one-round election. Whoever gets a plurality of the vote will win. It doesn't go to a second round like in many other Latin American countries. And right now the polls are showing Castro could win. But the big question is now, will the National Party and Hernandez and his supporters in the military and the business sectors, fearing a shift more to the center left in Honduras, will they resort to fraud and violence to prevent that? And if so, what will be the response of the Biden administration to that? I really don't think Honduras can afford another repeat of 2017. It's horrendous what happened then. And for it to happen now under Biden's watch would just undermine everything that Kamala Harris and Biden have said about addressing the root causes of corruption and impunity.
Dr. Neil Harvey is the head of the NMSU Government Department, joining us today to discuss the root causes of migration. We are also joined by economist Dr. Chris Erickson and associate professor of economics, Dr. Jose Buccelli. Dr. Buccelli, we're kind of focusing in first on the what we refer to as the Northern Triangle. So we just got done with a great explanation of what we've got our eyes on happening in Honduras. Would you like to take over with El Salvador or Guatemala? Your choice.
I was actually going to provide a very clear example of the rampant corruption in Honduras and what we're looking forward to. Back in 2018, Congressman Tony Hernandez, the brother of the Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez, was arrested in Miami on drug charges, and he was sentenced to life in prison. So that provides further context to the situation that we are dealing with. Now, looking at Guatemala and El Salvador, those are two very interesting cases for different reasons, or for the same reason, but taking different paths. The flow of Guatemalans right now is at the highest level it has been, way beyond Honduras and El Salvador. The flow of migrants from El Salvador is actually declining because the situation in El Salvador is improving, particularly the situation surrounding security and violence in El Salvador. It used to be, it's still among the most dangerous or most violent countries in the world, but that situation has been brought under control recently. Not completely under control, but the situation is improving. So the number of migrants from El Salvador has actually started to decline, but Guatemala remains at the top of the list.
So let's focus on some of the factors that exist in Guatemala to continue that issue.
So Guatemala, one of the factors that pushes migrants out of Guatemala, well, of course, it's poverty, it's unemployment, but we also have to consider the demographic factors. Guatemala has the fastest population growth in the region. Is high. It has had high fertility rates. So for the past decades, it has a large share of the population younger than 15. So these are a lot of people who are coming of age. They're looking for a job and not finding those economic opportunities in Guatemala. So they're looking for other countries. And naturally, if there's already migrants from Guatemala living in the U.S., many of them are wanting to reunite with their parents.
And what would you credit the improvement in El Salvador with?
So there are many factors, and let me take a step back here. First, the rise in violence has actually been attributed to some of the deportations from the U.S. That might sound counterintuitive, but actually Mara Salvatrucha, MS-13, and the other gang, M-18, actually started in the United States in the streets of L.A. and Washington. Then a lot of these criminal migrants were deported back to Central America. This created the gangs in Central America, which gave rise to violence in the entire region. Now, since then, the U.S. has played an active role in terms of collaboration with authorities there regarding drug trafficking, but also development initiatives that had actually contributed to the development in the region. That's why I think it's so dangerous when the Trump administration decided to withdraw the foreign aid to these countries back in 2019.
Dr. Erickson, maybe this would be a good opportunity for you to pick up in terms of aid and how that can be a good or bad thing.
Well, aid can be very effective. It can also be ineffective and lead to corruption when you give aid to countries where the officials are corrupt. I do want to play a little bit on the theme that Dr. Harvey brought up and then Jose emphasized also, which is the incredible importance of the rule of law in economic development and in the role in immigration. Economists, again, not just in Latin America, but around the world, have looked at the role of rule of law, corruption, bribe giving, bribe taking, and have found consistently that this has a negative impact on economic development. And when it even breaks down to the point where we're talking not just about corruption, but active violence, it's very disruptive to the economies of these countries and promotes immigration to the United States. So actions taken by the United States, by the Organization of American States, and by other international organizations to help eliminate corruption, to help reduce violence is critical for eliminating the immigration flow we're coming from the Northern Triangle and elsewhere in the world too, the United States. And moreover, it's the right thing to do. I mean, these people are suffering tremendous hardships from the violence and from the corruption within their societies. I mean, we underestimate in the United States, and we complain about about corruption in Washington, D.C., but it's not of the same form as you see in Latin America and other countries around the world, developing countries. A lobbyist who takes a congressman out to dinner is not the same thing is not as disruptive and debilitating as having to pay a traffic ticket on the street in what's a blatant bribe to a policeman, for example, which is the kind of corruption, everyday corruption, that erodes people's confidence in their government and their society. So I agree with Jose and Neil both on the need for U.S. actions to the extent that we are able to promote democracy, but also just the rule of law in Latin America and in the Northern Triangle.
Dr. Harvey, you mentioned some of the repressive ways that protest was addressed in Honduras. Maybe we could talk about over the years what we saw happen in Guatemala along those lines.
Sure. We've just been talking about the past few years or this year, what's coming up next month and so on. But this does have a longer history. Trying to think of the United States' role in Central America, has it been in support of the rule of law? Maybe rhetorically, yes, but practically, no. It has helped undermine the rule of law on many occasions. Talking about Guatemala, the most egregious example was how the CIA helped orchestrate a military coup in 1954 against the democratically elected government of Juan José Arévalo, largely because his mild proposals for land reform would affect the unused lands of the United Fruit Corporation at that time in Guatemala to provide access to agricultural land for thousands of Guatemalan campesinos, or peasants. That sparked the fear among some circles in Washington that this was a beachhead for the Soviet Union in the early Cold War years, and that couldn't be permitted, and so better to have the military come in and govern. That had horrendous consequences for Guatemala, which we're still seeing the effects of today. Over 200,000 Guatemalans lost their lives at the hands of brutal repression, particularly in the early 1980s, again with the support of the Reagan administration and support for Rios Montt, a general who embarked on a program to destroy whole communities, wipe them off the map, simply because they were suspected of possibly harboring sympathies for the left-wing guerrilla organizations at that time. So many Guatemalans suffered. Many fled into southern Mexico, across the border into Chiapas in the early 80s, and lived in camps there for a while. Some integrated into Mexican society, and some were eventually able to return to Guatemala in the mid-90s after the peace accords, only to find that their lands had been taken over by the military for their own purposes. So a lot of these effects go back to something that's often forgotten or not studied or known about very much, is the impacts, the real impacts that U.S. interventionism, the military support, and the training for officers in places like Guatemala and El Salvador in the 80s had on those societies. So I think there's that part of the story really needs to be known and recognized. There's never been an apology from the United States to Guatemalans who suffered at the hands of those regimes with the help of the U.S. And I think now is a good time to think about how could that begin to be addressed. And one is to say no more fraudulent elections, no more support for violent imposition of political will just because it favors a few corporate interests of American companies.
Dr. Buccelli, let's talk about some of the reasons that exist that you are hopeful. You mentioned improvements in El Salvador. What other signs do you see that there could be improvements, and how do you think those will come about?
Improvements in the sense of a better treatment of migrants, accept them as they are. They're looking for better lives. Imagine what it might take for a person to walk across Mexico into another country. So first to accept that. But from the Biden administration, I do see some positive aspects. I see a re-engagement with the region, a re-engagement with Guatemala, with El Salvador, with Honduras, reinstating the foreign aid development programs, a more friendly approach towards the entire region. And I think that the Biden administration has realized that this is not only a Northern Triangle problem. If we think about the recent arrival of Haitian migrants, these are migrants who left their country of origin 10 years ago or more after the earthquake. So I believe that the Biden administration has realized that it is time to actually engage with the region and with all the partners.
That was actually the next item on my list. It is 1:40, and this is Voice of the Public. I'm Casey Counts. Thank you for joining us today. And if you have a thought or a question you'd like to pass on, 575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call. We're joined by NMSU Government Department Head Dr. Neil Harvey, economist Dr. Chris Erickson, and Associate Professor of Economics Dr. Jose Buccelli. So as far as the Haitian migrants go, I think that that was a surprise to some, and a lot of people had no idea how people got from Haiti to to the U.S.-Mexico border in such numbers. And you mentioned that they had been living in Chile for since the earthquake of 2010. Dr. Harvey, maybe you can address some of the reasons that they wanted to leave Chile.
Well, I think, as has been mentioned, after the earthquake in 2010, which came after a series of other natural disasters and the general economic difficulties in Haiti, and many were able to arrive in South America, particularly through Ecuador, and from Ecuador went to Chile or Brazil. But the downturn in the economies there and the lack of opportunities, which I think we also see in Mexico when we say, well, why don't people just seek asylum in Mexico? In general, in Latin America, those opportunities are not really prevalent, particularly for migrants, and the very hostile reception often to migrants also. We've just seen that recently in Chile also, not only towards Haitians, but to Venezuelans arriving to xenophobic response there, a very strong one, which is also being used politically to whip up support for a candidate in the election coming up there. But going back to this fundamental question, I think we are looking at a more global question of where are people feeling the ability to find safety and opportunity for themselves with their families, and it's not in the countries that we've been talking about. So people are making a very difficult decision to seek to come to the Mexico-U.S. border in spite of all of the obstacles, and even making the way through very dangerous terrain of the Darien Gap, the section of Panama that joins to Colombia, which is largely impassable for most people. But there are thousands of migrants now who are trying to pass through there, many who died in the process. Simply deporting people back to Haiti is no solution to it. And you really need, as an international community, to take this seriously. If you look at migration from African countries to Southern Europe, the difficulties of trying to cross the Mediterranean and arrive on European soils, this isn't just U.S.-Mexico border, but it's a global question.
Dr. Erickson, you had a thought?
Yeah, well, I think this illustrates a theme that's been going through this whole broadcast, which is that this is deeply rooted in history. You know, Haiti was the first country, I think maybe the only country, that gained its independence through a slave revolt. That slave revolt resulted in an embargo imposed on many countries on Haiti, the United States in particular, which remember, we're talking about this is the 1820s, 1830s. And so slave interests in the South imposed economic sanctions on Haiti through the national government. And Haiti has in some ways never recovered from that action by the United States and other countries in the 19th century. And you can trace the extreme poverty in Haiti, and that Haiti is the poorest country in our hemisphere, back to those actions. And this illustrates the moral requirement that Dr. Harvey has alluded to, that Neil's alluded to, about the need for U.S. action help alleviate the poverty in that country. And of course, the knock-on positive effects for the United States, of course, is to stem the tide of unwanted immigration. And also, again, to make people better off in Haiti, to make them and make it a better place to live.
A note, in case you're not aware, the images that we saw coming from the border of the Haitians arriving there are from a local photographer, Paul Ratchie, hoping to catch up with him soon to hear about his experience there. Dr. Buccelli?
Yes, I wanted to contribute with an additional dimension that I think it is very important to understand when we're talking about Haitian migration, and that is racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, not only in the United States, but throughout the region. Haitians first moved into Brazil to work as temporary workers for the Olympics, for the Summer Games, for the World Cup. As policies changed, new restrictions were enacted, Jair Bolsonaro came to power, migrants looked for somewhere else to move. They went to Chile, which offered a more welcoming environment. That changed with the election of Sebastián Piñera, and migrants decided to move once again. In July of 2021, actually, the United States offered temporary protective status to Haitian migrants. So this might have also encouraged this migration from the region.
This is not, this is a conversation we could carry on over many hours, and it is already 1:46. And so I want to focus with the time we have left on what each of you thinks is important for Americans to know about the people and the region and the reasons that they are leaving, and on what thoughts you have in regard to how much of a change in U.S. policy is required moving forward. Dr. Harvey, why don't you begin?
Yeah, I think the region, anyone who's traveled to any Latin American country is always impressed by the vibrancy of Latin American societies, the resiliency of the peoples, the hospitality, and the great cultural traditions which have allowed people to some way create societies which may not be the most egalitarian, but for many people are ways in which they live in the world and interact with other communities. Unfortunately, politically, much of that cultural vibrancy, particularly of indigenous peoples, when we refer to Guatemala, for example, has not been valued, has not been recognized by the powers that be. And when there have been movements to try and reform those political systems, they've often been put down quite violently, as we were just mentioning in the case of Guatemala. So I think one of the things that Americans can do is to pay attention to the political changes that are occurring outside of the United States, further south in Mexico and Central America. To call, I think, initially, in the short term, there is this election coming up in Honduras. If Americans are concerned about migrants from Honduras arriving in large numbers, if we ask ourselves, well, why are we concerned about that? And if we answer, well, we're concerned about it because we'd really like Hondurans to be able to live a safe and comfortable existence in their home communities, then write to your congressional representatives, your senators, and call on them to ensure that the elections in Honduras are held to the standard of that Honduran people now expect, which would be free and fair. In other words, not to commit the same error of 2013 and particularly of 2017 of ignoring or minimizing the impact that electoral fraud has on the will of a people. To call out fraud and to allow for, without saying which candidate, but simply to allow that election to take place freely and fairly. Otherwise, I think all of the rhetoric about addressing root causes will mean nothing to the people in Honduras if the United States allows for a fraudulent election to take place. I think that in the immediate term is one thing to be looking out for, and we have congressional representatives denouncing fraud and repression. They're doing it right now in Nicaragua. Well, Honduras too is also of concern. So I'll leave it there.
Dr. Buccelli?
I would invite listeners to focus on the consequences of having higher migration into the U.S., which I actually call benefits of higher migration. The first one, of course, is humanitarian. The U.S. is by tradition a humanitarian country. Since the adoption of the 1980 Refugee Act, the country has admitted more than 3 million refugees fleeing persecution and war from around the world, not only from Central America. But beyond that, beyond the humanitarian sense, think about the economic reasons or the economic impact that allowing for migration has on places of origin. As an example, remittances are a significant source of income. This is money that migrants send back home, are a significant source of income for these countries. In 2010, last year, El Salvador received nearly $6 billion in remittances. That accounts for over 20% of their GDP. So allowing these flows, allowing migrants to come and work here legally, that puts or decreases the pressure on local jobs and resources in El Salvador. Another thing that we've seen with Mexican migrants is that many of them just come temporarily. They come, they work, they save, and they actually migrate back home. At the end of the 2000s, we actually saw that the trend reversed, where more Mexican migrants were returning back to Mexico. And this contributed to the development of their home communities. But also the economic benefits for the destination countries, in this case, the U.S. We hear every day in the news about much-needed labor force. Well, let's allow people to come in to pay taxes, to save, and potentially to return back to their home countries, but on their own volition. And finally, I think that a more diverse society, culturally in terms of population, is just a richer society.
Dr. Erickson?
Well, you know, I think our discussion here has emphasized the deep-rooted causes of problems in Latin America. And the United States has a limited ability to influence Latin America, but it's not a zero. Ability. And Neil has emphasized the need for the United States to take an active role in Honduras, but also all through Latin America, and one could argue maybe perhaps in other developing countries and other regions, that to really be a voice for democracy. And I think in a very real sense, in the 1990s and the 2000s, the United States has kind of ignored Latin America. We focused more on the Middle East, on the Persian Gulf, on Afghanistan. And that has not been good news for Latin America in many cases, particularly the countries we're focusing on today. And so what we can do, we should do. And what we can do is we can help with free and fair elections. What we can do is provide financial aid to governments that engage in activities that are beneficial for their own populations. And we also can act against governments that are corrupt and acting in ways that are contrary to the best interests of the general population of their countries. Jose just brought the issue of immigrants in the United States, and there's no question the immigrants are a huge contributor to the culture of the United States, the richness of the United States. Those of us who live on the border are almost certainly people who really enjoy that cultural diversity. You wouldn't pick to live in the border area if you weren't someone who really valued that, and so I think our listeners here will probably agree with us. Maybe they'll agree with us for other reasons too, but they'll agree with us for that reason. And you know, one of the things that always strikes me when I travel outside of our region is the real ignorance that's a harsh word, I know, the real ignorance that some people outside the border region have about immigration and about the border region and about the way we live our lives here on the border, and that anti-immigrant hostility that was reflected in the election of 2016 is in the United States is something that we need to work with our family members, with our friends, to try to overcome. It's a difficult thing to do because you can easily argue someone into their position rather than out of their position. We who live here in the border, I think, need to spread that message of the value of immigration, the value of cultural diversity.
You know, I'm ignorant about a lot of things, and I don't see it as a negative thing. Willful ignorance is something that's completely different. Yeah. And it's just 5 minutes to go here, so if you would like to sneak in a question or comment, I think we might have time for that. 575-646-2212. This is Voice of the Public, and our topic today, the root causes of migration, with NMSU Government Department Head Dr. Neil Harvey, economist Dr. Chris Erickson, and Associate Professor of Economics at NMSU, Dr. Jose Buccelli. Maybe we could just spend a couple of minutes. There was something that was on my mind, and it seems like when I'm in my international relations class, I see the value of liberal trade policy. And then when I'm in my Latin American politics class, I see all these harms from liberal trade policy. And so I'd like to ask you, Dr. Erickson, in terms of, you know, maybe from a macroeconomic sense, what's the right balance?
Well, the answer is that international trade is disruptive. There are people who are harmed by it, and those people, we need to take actions to help them. But in general, in most cases, in fact, virtually every case, international trade is beneficial to the economies as a whole. If you look at countries that don't engage in international trade, either voluntarily themselves or because of actions taken internationally against them, Cuba, Korea, North Korea, you can think of other examples, they are countries that are impoverished, that are not as able to take care of their communities, their people as can countries that engage in. Both Cuba, and again, I know that that's imposed by the United States, of both Cuba and North Korea and Myanmar, I think you throw in that pot too, have had periods of famine in recent decades as a result of their isolation from international trade. Something you don't really hear of very often in countries that engage in international trade. Not unheard of course, in other countries, but it's much rarer. And these countries, the benefits of international trade, of course, are also have to be taken into account. Is the cost, which among other things, is the loss of local cultural identity. If everybody is buying the same bowl of cereal and using the same shampoo and buying the same products, you lose that local cultural identity that we've just been talking about, how it enriches the United States to have immigrants that do that. And of course, this can affect people around the world. My own experience, I don't know if Neil and Jose share this. My own experience has been that when I travel to countries that are lower income, that have less integration of the world economy, I'm thinking India in this case, the cultures tend to be much, much more different, much different kinds of cultures than when you travel to countries where they're highly integrated into the world culture, highly integrated in international trade. And I'm thinking of Taiwan and also in Latin America. You find that those countries are more similar than the countries that are not as integrated in international trade. And that's a loss to humanity. Well, but the benefits are generally higher incomes for people with international trade. Although there are, of course, they take into account disruptions. You know, for example, with the passage of NAFTA, many small farmers in Mexico were dislocated from their homes. And that was a terrible cost to those people and those families and those communities from which they were dislocated. And they were forced into urban areas to find jobs. And that is, and that is a terrible outcome for the people who were directly affected by those negative impacts. You know, the solution to that can be, again, aid from rich trading partners. The United States could provide aid to Mexico to help with those adjustment processes, or other countries in the world that we trade with heavily. Generally, I think that, international trade has been the driver of world growth. Another issue that comes up with this, I know I'm trying to keep track of the time.
We have about 45 seconds. Another issue
because of this I want to mention very quickly that Neil mentioned early on is global warming, which is driven by international trade. It's not inherent in international trade, but we haven't taken the actions needed to mitigate it when it comes to international trade at this point.
I think we're going to have to plan for another program with you very soon, but we are out of time for today. Dr. Erickson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Neil Harvey, welcome to KRWG's Voice of the Public. Thanks. You got the first one down. We hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.
And Dr. Buccelli, thank you. We hope you'll come back and join us again for another program soon as well.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
And coming up next on KRWG, it's Leora Zeitlin and Intermezzo by request.